You're listening to Waiting on Reparations, a production of iHeartRadio.
Dope, dope, dope.
We wait no reparations.
Hurry up.
We wait no reparations.
Hurry up.
My head is spinning around like a merry go. Tell them yakin' sounding like Shakira on the karaoke. But it's not that Jack and Cherry Coke. It's the kerosene, the air is soaked, dropping canaries cold. Another brother, martyred, he was barely grown. Ooh. Mama sobbing like the bottom, octave of a baritone. Watching as they bury him. The cops said that his anger had been flaring up the blocks. So, hey, you better prepare yourself. We keep a monitor past the binoculars, dropping periscope. We sending in Leslie Nope under the auspices of Robin Hood. We got no other option. Take a portion of the pot and distribute it to the barrio. Marching into Congress. Take it all across America.
Pay homage to the god of the rhyme. Shoot you motherfucking rappers like it's clobbering time. Black version of Optimus Prime. But my product design served the last person with a soldering iron. I'm leaving y'all intertwined and you caught in a bind. There's mad topics to find though when I'm on the grind. Till the cheers fade away and it's time to retire. I'm the pain in the ass you hoping would die in a fire. Your shit is make believe. And when I'm busting, son, I play for keeps. You bums are nothing but a bunch of motherfucking waste of beats. I'm a beast on stage or on a vacant street. Step in a sight. And they bolt with that Jamaican speed. I knock them down, shake peers with a lot of style. Box a mile, giving you faker tears than crocodiles. And you crack smoking, I'm only half choking. I'm Bane, you the bat poking, get your back broken. Dope.
Hey.
My name's Dope Knife.
I'm Lingua Franca.
And we are waiting on reparations.
Hurry up.
And we are back again for another episode. How are you doing?
I'm fine.
Only fine.
I'm just tripping because, so earlier today, I saw my psychiatrist on the little Zoom on, Skype or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just talking about, the upcoming wave of evictions and the waning of the protests and the unemployment benefits running out and Congress not giving a shit enough about working people to pass anything to help us. And he was like, well, do you think your medication is working? And I'm like, does it fucking sound like it? You hear the tone in my voice as I describe the horror with which I'm surveying the world. And it's just this interesting moment where he was like, yeah, you're right. Guess there's nothing really I can do to help you.
I was just because
the world is a fucking hellscape.
Well, yeah,
so,
no, I mean,
have a good day. That'll be $250. You're welcome.
It's ridiculous that it's the first thing that he would think to say is, do you want some drugs? Or are you taking your drugs?
Taking your drugs. So the drugs are working. It's like, what the fuck do you think?
Nah, I feel you though. For real, I got hit by a wave of depression a few days ago where I was just down for 2 days straight. And it was just because, normally since, you know the whole deal is when you make music independently and when you're an independent artist, you're always thinking two or three steps ahead. If you're smart, you're thinking about what you're going to be doing, 5 months from now. And it's just with everything going on, it's been hard to have that sort of vision, and envisioning the future mm-hmm. that. So it was just putting me down. But, then I had to start working on the episode, and that kind of brought me up. So here we are.
Here we are, yeah.
Oh,
you know what else did happen? Yeah, so earlier this week, the police department here in Athens released the results of their internal investigation about their conduct the night of May 31st, which was the big march that I led, and then a bunch of my friends got tear gassed and shot with less lethal munitions and
so what
arrested.
Was their findings?
What do you think they fucking found?
I'm assuming they didn't do anything wrong, according to them.
We investigated ourselves and found we did no wrongdoing. And it's so funny because, at first they didn't admit that they used, beanbag rounds, and now they admit they did. They claimed that, protesters were hiding, bricks in their tents that they were going to fucking throw at the cops. And now they admit that no bricks were found on the folks they arrested. And it's they're admitting to all these lies in this report that's supposed to absolve them of any wrongdoing
because
they conducted a thorough investigation.
I mean, it doesn't even make sense that anyone do an investigation on themselves like that. It's have you ever read the comic book Watchmen?
No.
You haven't? Or there's like
Well, who watches The Watchmen is like
the Yeah, that's yeah, like the yeah, same. Yeah, yeah. yeah exactly.
I've seen
who
the fucking film. The
okay.
Sir.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, the, you know,
yeah, but who watches The Watchmen? I mean, like, it's on some street level shit of like, nobody snitch.
Mm-hmm, exactly. But I mean, that's just how it is. It's just like any sort of like gang or organized group where everyone's looking out for each other and no one's gonna. They look at everybody else as being the outsiders and they look at themselves as being like, you know, the inner circle and yeah. they don't deviate outside that quote unquote family, so to
yeah.
speak.
Yeah. First rule of Fight Club is you don't talk about Fight Club. They don't fucking say shit to nobody to turn in their own under any circumstances. What does that sound like to you?
Sounds like a fucking gang to me. Gang, 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 gang.
That brings us to our topic of today.
Before we get on that, let me give a shout out to the homie Juan Cosby out of Cincinnati, Ohio. He's the one who's providing the beats for today. That's Juan Cosby at Juan Cosby on Instagram. So go check him out and holler at him for some beats because he's got some fire. All right.
Yeah, I think when you look at the history and then of policing and look at the history of gangs, there's so many parallels and moments of intersection that kind of spring up. And so,
I mean, at this point, it's almost like a, you know, we say it all the time, and that's what this episode is about. But at this point, it's kind of even a cliche, the comparison of police to gangs, because it's like something that everybody pretty much accepts to this point, especially the
way
that America.
Yeah, and when I talk about parallels, I'm not talking about like a linkage between like police budgets and like crime rates, because nationally that has not been found to exist. But rather the way the parallels in
like
their
culture.
Culture and the way they operate.
Yeah. And to touch on that, we're going to be talking with hip hop and spoken word artist Propaganda, who's the co-host and host, respectively, of the Behind the Police and Hood Politics podcast. But how did we end up here? Like, how did we end up with what we have as a centralized police force in America? Policing in the United States mirrored the development of policing in England. One informal form it took was referred to as WATCH, or private for profit policing.
Yeah, so the WATCH system was made up of like community volunteers with the main duty of warning incoming danger. So between like 1636 and 1700, a similar night watch was created in Boston, New York, and Philadelphia.
Now, the night watch wasn't really that effective at controlling crime because for the most part, those guys were drinking and falling asleep while they were on duty.
And most volunteers were trying to avoid military service and were drafted into service by their town or were performing watch duties as punishment.
Another system was the constable system, official law enforcement officers. They were paid a fee for warrants they served. Constables had a bunch of non-law enforcement jobs as well, including land surveyors and weights and measure inspectors.
And then in the South, policing had its roots in slave patrols, or squads of white volunteers given the green light to enforce laws related to slavery, capturing and returning escaped slaves, quelling slave rebellions, and enforcing plantation rules with harsh and often sadistic punishments. The first slave patrol was in modern-day South Carolina in 1704. And they had three primary functions: to chase down, apprehend, and return slaves to their owners, to provide a form of organized terror to deter slave revolts, and to maintain a form of discipline for slave workers who were subject to plantation justice outside of the law if they violated any plantation rules. After the Civil War, these vigilante groups merged into modern Southern police departments, mainly as a way of controlling freed former slaves who were now working in the agricultural caste system, enforcing a set of racist government policies called the Black Codes, designed to deny free black people equal rights and access to the political system. The codes also restricted traveling and housing. In 1868, the Black Codes were rendered illegal by the 14th Amendment, but within 20 years, Jim Crow segregation laws got around that and were adopted across the South. And enforcement of those laws was put in the hands of, guess fucking who? The police! Whoop, whoop.
That's the sound of the police! Whoop. That's the sound of the beast.
In the 1830s is when the idea of a centralized municipal police department first emerged in the United States. And it's really funny because I got in arguments with people on Instagram about this, because on 4th of July, I posted about the fact that, you know, we're celebrating this holiday about the founding of our country. Mm-hmm. And in 1776, the police as we know it did not exist in America. And for the majority of human history, indeed,
policing as an institution, as the centralized municipal police department that, you know, emerged in the 1830s, did not exist throughout human society. And so when we talk about abolition, et cetera, we're really talking about, in a sense, getting back to our roots of like other forms of accountability and other forms of security and public safety through like community based, like, you know, not just seeing your neighbors, not just watching your neighbors, but like seeing them for who they are
and understanding like, them.
Yeah. And so,
I feel like that's what a lot of this moment and what's going on is about like completely changing people's whole way of looking at stuff.
Yeah.
You know, more so than just necessarily reforming an institution, you know.
Yeah, no, I think the idea of like even, you know, defunding the police or police abolition requires us to stop outsourcing all of our problems to the state. It asks a lot more of us as private citizens to, you know, be alert and like surveying the conditions on our street, not just for crime to occur, but crime prevention strategies and making sure our neighbors have everything they need. I mean, we could talk about expanding the quote unquote welfare state as a way to deter crime, but ultimately I do think it comes down to like mutual aid and like mutual accountability on like community level and like the responsibility that requires of us. People are like, I don't have to do all that shit. I don't have to make sure my fucking neighbors got fucking Cheerios and fucking milk.
Well, I mean, the thing
like,
is like
that.
And this is, I guess, is kind of where, you know, not growing up here kind of comes into perspective for me. But it's just like, I don't know how, if you know that there are people who are hungry, like, how do you walk around it, like thinking that there shouldn't or won't be crime of some sort?
Yeah.
Like, you think people are just going to like starve? I mean, I know it's all relative, like everybody's definition of what they're, but if you, we all live this life in America knowing that it's unfair and it's unequal and a lot of people have it harder than other people.
The fuck you think that
what,
they're going
to exactly, do? Exactly. Like, what do you think is going to happen? I'm not saying that that's right. I'm saying, what do you expect to happen? You know?
Yeah. So, I was helping organize folks as a part of the national Strike for Black Lives, where SEIU and Teamsters and the Poor People's Campaign and other allied organizations across the country were encouraging workers to walk off the job. And how I was explaining, like, what relevance this held for the moment that we're in is that economic justice is racial justice. In a world without crimes of survival, our reliance upon the institution of policing is greatly decreased, some might even argue eliminated. And so when we address those economic justice issues of people having those foundational needs met so that they can thrive, through, you know, living wage employment or through a strong social safety net that helps them gain and keep meaningful employment, we won't have to worry about, you know, homies down here fighting outside the homeless shelter. But anyway, I'm sorry I got a little bit off topic. So police have only existed in America for like a little shy of 200 years.
Yeah.
One reason that they first emerged was that cities were growing, and with the U.S. no longer being a collection of small cities and rural towns, with urbanization occurring at a pace that made the watch and constable systems no longer good enough to stop this disorder, they had to transition to something more centralized.
Now, we'll come back to that word, disorder, but the general...
Disorder, yeah.
The general public disorder was more visible and less easily controlled in growing urban centers than it had been in rural areas. Increasing crime, invisible vice, you know, public drunkenness and sometimes prostitution, mob violence, particularly violence directed at immigrants and African Americans, took place frequently. But there is no evidence that there was like a crime wave back then that made them say, hey, we gotta fucking start a centralized police force. Like, that's not really what was going on.
Yeah, and I think the key word here is visible vice, because I think Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in a recent interview was talking about how what folks, and this has been contested by abolitionists, but like was talking about how folks need to think of defunding the police as advocating for black communities to be policed like white communities are. White communities where visible vice is not so much of an issue. People aren't drinking out on the street corner or standing out, you know, out by the stop sign, hooking. because they're doing these things behind closed doors on private property where they're not seen, and thus it kind of keeps this image of public order.
Kentucky University criminologist Gary Potter, in his paper, The History of Policing in the United States, stated, "More than crime, modern police forces in the United States emerge as a response to, quote, disorder. What constitutes social and public order depends largely on who is defining those terms. And in the cities of the 19th century America, they were defined by mercantile interests, whose taxes and political influence supported the development of bureaucratic policing institutions. These economic interests had a greater interest in social control than crime control. Private and for-profit policing was too disorganized and too crime-specific and formed to fulfill these needs. The emerging commercial elites needed a mechanism to ensure a stable and orderly workforce, a stable and orderly environment to conduct of business, and the maintenance of what they referred to as the collective good. These mercantile interests also wanted to divest themselves the cost of protecting their own enterprises, transferring those costs from the private sector to the state." Hey, so we got a special guest today.
Oh, yes, we do.
Who is that, Mariah? Do you want to introduce
him? We have Jason Emmanuel Petty, or known to the world as a propaganda. 1 ounce of crack gains the same amount of jail time as 18 of cocaine, but ain't they the same thing? It's crooked. Stay eating our own kind and muster up a scandal instead of celebrating shining. A hip-hop and spoken word artist and poet from Los Angeles, California, and the co-host of Behind the Police and Hood Politics. Prop, how are you today?
I'm all right, man. You know, you gave a full government, though. You know what I'm saying? I'm just,
I didn't mean to put you on blast.
We can edit it out if you want us to.
You can leave it there. You feel me? The fans is watching. You know what I'm talking about?
I know we are talking about the police. So.
You feel me? Nah, we good. No, I'm good, man. We on a personal note, are like, the house we're renting, we're looking into buying. So, ooh. Which is super dope, which means now I have an office. I'm over here, like, not recording in my bedroom with my, like, daughter taking her nap right on the other side of the wall. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. Tell us a little bit about yourself for folks that may not be familiar with the work.
Yeah.
Like, how would you describe yourself?
Man, I'm a tall drink of water. Nah, I am South Central Los Angeles, you know, born and bred in L.A., moved around the cornucopia, Los Angeles. I don't know how familiar the listeners are, but like San Gabriel Valley, you know, Whittier, Long Beach, I've lived in pretty much all of it. Lived in IE for a little bit. My mom's from DC, dad's from Texas. My father was a Black Panther. Fell in love with hip hop in Leimert Park in LA. And I went to college for illustration and intercultural studies. And then I went on to get a master's in social science. I taught history for 6 years. And I was just a hardcore battle rapper the whole time, you know, and then, you know what I'm saying? Fell in love with poetry in college. And
a lot of similarities in our story, man.
Right. And just kind of been like, you know, there was a moment where I had to make a decision as far as like, was I going to continue in education, be a teacher, or like, you know, there's opportunities were arising. It's kind of funny story. I know your listeners will appreciate it. Like crew I was with was we produced an album on KRS-One, and he was gonna take us on tour. So I was yo, I'm out this job. The teacher's gonna take me on tour. This is my shot, you know what I'm saying? And it wasn't my shot, but it was an amazing experience, you know what I'm saying, and I'll never forget it. But either way, that was like, I left the classroom around that time, and then I've kind of been doing music and poetry and sort of activism. I come from an activist family, like I said, my father was a Panther, so I kind of came from that already and just kind of been doing that ever since.
So what was his involvement with the Panthers? Like, was he an organizer? Was he like, because I know they did a lot of different kinds of things for like community uplift.
Yeah, so Pops was a after school tutor, and he was doing like some of the busing, the transfers things. My father was at the Watts chapter of 41st and Central down here, the CIA bomb. Yeah. He was a part of the after school tutoring. My dad, you know, after he came back from Vietnam, he was went on to to go to UCLA and get his Afro studies degree in sociology. So my father was a very intelligent man. And so his big thing was like, education's the way. So that was where he participated the most, was in the after school tutoring.
And how has how have those activist roots influenced the way you move in the world?
Man, it's hard to not see the need, and it's hard to not see, you know, sort of a much more sort of intersectional, kind of like a very just inclusive understanding of what, you know, interlocking systems of justice look like, how to have advocacy across different borders and different lines, because of, again, the way that, like, I was taught to even understand power and how you interface with power and how power interfaces with the population. You know, it was just because of that sort of, like I said, like, very well-read activism that, like, my father had. It's like, you just, you were able to see it everywhere. And then secondly, just being from LA, like, I was on the east side of South Central. I know that's a lot of directions, but on the east side of South Central, it bordered the Latino community. So we were butting up against, like, the next street over was an area called Huntington Park, which, I mean, there's no signs in English in Huntington Park. You know what I'm saying? So, like, I lived on this, like, borderlands to where I understood the immigrant, the, you know, specifically the Mexican-American immigrant experience, and could just see so many, like, I'm like, they, that's same shit. Like, they doing that. You know what I'm saying? So it was just hard to not notice it and realize that, like, a lot of our work, what we was doing and what my father was doing for the Black community was like, yo, like, y'all could do this too. Like, y'all need this too. You know what I'm saying? And so that, like, sort of intersectional understanding, I think, just kind of came from having that, like, activist, like, father. You know what I'm saying?
Are there any, like, areas where your hip hop and your activism, like, intersect?
I mean, the whole time. Like, that's the funny part. Like, again, you know, the wing of hip hop I fell in love with, and I know that's another similarity because I saw the songs y'all chose for this episode, is like, you know, I grew up going to, you know, I don't know how familiar you are with just like the LA rap scene as far as like Good Life. I know,
like, Good Life, yeah. Project Load. Yeah,
so, no, yeah, I grew up going to that. Like, I was too young, so I was too young for the Good Life. I snuck in a few times, right? But it was a health food cafe, so it's like, I mean.
So what, for people who might not know what that is, what is the Good Life?
So the Good Life was an open mic sort of like workshop that evolved into sort of this like battle scene, but.
You couldn't curse.
Yeah, it was very clean. You couldn't curse because of. Sort of our kind of patriarch of that area. Like, Leimert Park was the sort of like LA's Harlem. So a lot of like activism, old jazz, like a lot of the 60s stuff. It was right on Crenshaw Boulevard, again, which is like Black Renaissance areas of Los Angeles. So it was already a community that was like, our elders were activists. Our elders were like, you know, were these. So if hip hop was gonna be born there, it was gonna look like where we were born in. You know what I'm saying?
That's so, like Freestyle Fellowship.
Yeah.
And stuff.
So these were like my heroes, you know? So Freestyle Fellowship. Like, I mean, I remember seeing Corrupt and Snoop.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I remember seeing these guys come to these open mics. I remember people flying in. The Juice and Supernatural battle. Like, that was it was at Blowed. You know what I'm saying? So, like,
Yeah.
So we saw these things. I remember, you know, at Unity, which was over on the American Miracle Mile, I'm doing all these like LA deep cuts, but like, that's where when M battled this guy named Otherwise, you know, for this event that like Dre saw him at, like, and M lost, you know what I mean? Like, that particular battle, he lost, you know what I'm saying? But like, you know, the Rhyme Fest battles, like all these different like moments, all these people were all already, their hip hop was already an act of protest. So if that's sort of the primordial soup that I kind of came from, it was like, this is what I knew. You know what I'm saying? This is what I understood. You know, we were in LA, but like, if you saw the Good Life documentary, like, we all weren't G-Funk. Like, we all weren't, we all came from
gang. Everybody was there was a bunch of different flavors going on.
You know, we all came from gang hoods, but like we weren't all gangsters,
about
you know
that.
What I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, so that's kind of like that stuff really sang to me.
So transitioning, like, so you've been a hip hop artist and an activist for all these years. How did you get into the podcast game? Because you're the co-host of the Behind the Police podcast,
and also
you got the Hood Politics podcast. So how'd you get into that?
Dude, I started doing music and, you know, and the type of music I was doing, I was getting a lot of like speaking opportunities. And then sort of, you know, I wrote a few op-eds for, you know, a couple outlets, and people started saying, yo, you should do a podcast. And at the time I was like, man, about what, man? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know what you want me to say. You know what I'm saying? And who's really going to tune in weekly? You feel me? And at the time, like, when it first started, I was like, well, I'm an artist. I don't have time. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, you have these, like, lofty ideas of not understanding, like, multiple streams of income and all this stuff. And just what a broad, like, fully developed artist you could be. So, anyway, I got offered a show that me and my wife actually started doing. It was called the Red Couch Podcast, which was where it originally started. I was offered by this magazine called Relevant. They were launching this like whole podcast network. They wanted me to be like the flagship. And so they were the ones that were like, you can write, you can do whatever you want. And I didn't, I was like, I don't about what, you know what I'm saying? So me and my wife just kind of made up the podcast, you know what I'm saying? And then out of that grew Hood Politics, because that Hood Politics at first was just a section in the broader, it was just one of the bits in Red Couch, you know what I'm saying? And then it kind of took its own life and was just, people were tuning in just for the first 20 minutes of the show. You know, just for the Hood Politics section, and then tuning out, and then other people were tuning in for the last 40 because they just wanted to hear my wife talk because she's brilliant in her own right. You know, actually in more right, she's a PhD in ed policy and social context. She's brilliant.
Oh, shit. I'm getting my PhD in language and literacy education.
Let's go. This is gonna be the hardest thing you do in your life. Let me tell you right now. I'm surprised our marriage lasts.
I totally understand.
Yes. Yeah. And she almost is funny at the end of that. She almost didn't want to like go through the like the ceremony and like walking across the stage. I was like, girl, I'm walking across. If you're not gonna walk, I'm gonna walk
across
the stage.
You
know what I'm saying? Like, that was the hardest thing. I can't believe it. Anyway, so it became like, for me, podcasting was just like this like creative way to get ideas out that I didn't have sort of like my identity so wrapped up into, like I did with like my hip hop, my poetry. Like, so it was like, this could just be, I could just, like the pressure was off. You know what I'm saying? Cause I just feel like this wasn't the air I breathed. And then it kind of like took on a life of its own. And now it's like, dude, I really love like podcasting. And then the Behind the Police thing was like legit just a DM. Like,
oh, word?
Yes, I was following, you know, Robert Evans' show.
Up, really? That's crazy.
His show is just, you know, I don't know if y'all familiar with the show Behind the Bastards. I was just a fan of it. And so I started following him, and we started like chopping it up back and forth, cracking jokes. And then I did a show on the Panthers with him. Like, he again direct messaged me, like, hey, because he said he was working on one. And I was like, oh, yeah, my dad was a Panther. So then he direct messaged me and was like, hey, you want to be on the show? And I was like, yeah. Well, I immediately like called my pops to be like, let me make sure I have like my timeline. I don't want to make a fool of myself on this thing. So, so we did the show. The show, like, you know, the numbers were pretty good. And then he had later on had this idea about the Behind the Police thing and was like, hey, do you want to like co-host with this with me? And it was legit just a direct message.
That's how it happened. That's good to know that, like, you can still, like, that can happen to anyone. With the age of social media, democratized information, democratized relationship making, like, yeah, it can happen to anybody. But yeah, talk to us a little bit about some topics that come up on Hood Politics, and then we'll talk a little bit about some of the highlights for you from being a part of Behind the Police.
Yeah, so Hood Politics is based on a really basic premise of if you survived inner city in any city in America, if you understood gang life, you understand geopolitics. Hell, if you survived eighth grade, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You understand geopolitics, because I honestly believe politics is just gangbanging in nice suits. Like, it's the same. So what I wanted to do with this pod is take, whether it's like hot takes from just like the current events or the current zeitgeist, or it's like, you know, continual threads, like, you know, whether it's America's like involvement in the Middle East, or what the hell a Cold War is, or how do you explain sanctions and tariffs and like all these things that, you know, are have its own language, have its own like, you know, vocabulary and stuff like that. And like people like you and me, oftentimes, especially if you ain't got no like, you know, suffixes at the end of your names, you ain't got no like degrees or nothing, you kind of feel like these people are like smarter than you. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, you can't, like, I'm not welcome into this conversation. And what I wanted to do with this pod was be like, actually, you understand this stuff very well. You know, you've been living it your whole life, especially from hood. So I say all that, for example, let's say we were talking about, let's just say we were talking about sanctions, right? So China's, you know, trying to, I don't know if you remember, we was in a tariff war, and so we was going to sanction China. China was going to do this, yada, yada. Like, we was going through all this stuff. And somebody said, well, what the hell is a sanction? And I'm like, well, it kind of works like this. Let's just say you, Mariah, are the plug, right? So you got all the weight. It's all in your hands, right? And, you know, I don't know, your little cousin Pookie, right? He live on the other side of town, and he wants to sell your weight, right? Well, and so Pookie over there with the Mariah weight, right? Mm-hmm. But Pookie's neighborhood get to be like, wait, hold up. We produce our own weight. You not allowed to. We got our own plug over here. You can't just be selling to my neighborhood like this. Right. And if you are, then like I'm gonna tax you for this. Like, then I need 40. You need to run 40% back to this block if you finna sell over here. Right. So at the end of the day, your cousin trying to sell your weed in his neighborhood, but his neighborhood not allowing him to sell unless he pays 40% is a sanction. You know what I'm saying? So I'm like, that's like, so, you know, that's
you
what I'm saying.
Know,
like, you know,
yeah,
this stuff. You already know how this works. It's just new vocabulary.
Right, they dress it
it's
up just, in language that's unfamiliar, but the processes themselves are incredibly familiar.
You already know it.
Yeah.
You already know it, right? We all know a Kim Jong-un.
Yeah.
We all know one. It's a little brother who's just mad that his big brother always gets to shine, and you can't ever say nothing to him because he's always ready to scrap. And if just, and the way to handle that dude, and you know he ain't gonna throw no punch, he's not gonna really do anything.
He just talk a lot of shit.
He just yell all the time. He just always talking shit. So you just like, yo, the best way to deal with him is to be like, okay, it's your world, big. It's your world, dog. No, nobody wanted with you. You good. Can you just chill though? Right? And then his big brother, which would be South Korea, being like, y'all can't, don't rile this fool up because I gotta go home.
Yeah, y'all ain't there.
And at some point, if he does lose it,
he gonna lose it on me.
Guess who gonna get it first? He gonna lose it on me. So y'all need to chill. Like,
I had a question. So it's funny that like you draw that comparison between geopolitics and hood politics and things. So do you see any? You know, people always talk about how the police are the biggest gang. There's a couple songs that we're going to be talking about where, you know, people make reference to that. So, like, what's your opinion on, like, just that parallel or that analogy between, like, police and them just being another gang on the street like every other gang?
I mean, it couldn't be more accurate. Like, especially when you go into, like, the stuff, like, just the history of the police. I just don't know. I can't see any distinction from a historical perspective. And then also from my own experience, it's like, okay, if I'm going to talk about just my own experience in inner city Los Angeles, if I turn down a particular street and I'm walking home with my new, like, you know, my new Jordans, new Air Force Ones, and I turn a corner coming home from school with a backpack, and I catch some boys in blue, whether they Crips or cops. It don't make no difference, right? If they come around that corner, one of them's gonna flag me down. Like, hey, homie, where you going? You know, it's like, oh, here we go. I'm going, where you stay at? Where your grandma stay? What you doing on this street? Right? I'm just cutting through. That's my family bang this, they from there, yada yada. They're like, oh, where you from? You know what I'm saying? They start going to ask me all these questions, mm-hmm. interrogations, and my only way out of this is either I'm finna catch a fade or I have to hand over equipment. Mm-hmm. Right? So I'm like, or I'm gonna be in trouble. I'm like, okay, that's street law. It's like, all right, this is what's finna happen. He gonna run my backpack, he gonna run my shoes, or I have to be like, I'll die for this. Mm-hmm. And I have to answer this dude like, listen, I will die for my backpack. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? And it's stupid, but it's like, those were the rules. So if I come around the corner and it's the cops, whoop, whoop, hey, sir, how you doing, young man? What are you doing here? No, really, really. Can I see your ID? Where do you live? I'm like, I'm having the same scenario. Where'd you get those shoes? Yeah, did you steal them? Maybe somebody got them. And I'm like, what? How are you finna ask me? Like, no, both my parents work, right? Okay, well, you seem to fit the description of someone that was causing trouble on this street. So I need to see what's in your backpack, what's this? And I'm like, it's the same scenario. You are finna go through my stuff. I'm about to get searched. And if I don't keep it cool, I'm finna catch a fade. So I'm like, I just don't. And y'all not gonna say nothing about each other, even if somebody is out of line.
I mean, the thing I was thinking of is the difference is that the police the gang, supposedly. But nobody polices the police.
Nobody policing them. Listen, on one of the episodes, I had my homeboy Bamboo. He's part of Soul Assassins. I don't even know if I'm familiar with him. So Bamboo was talking about, like, man, there are times that, like, and I was asking him, like, if he had any, like, if you remember any of the little hotheads in his hood that would get everybody in trouble. And he was like, yes, it was my own cousin, right? So, like, you know, you all sitting down, like, minding your own business. And then this fool starts mouthing off, which is basically what happened with us shooting Soleimani, right? Is like somebody started mouthing off, right? You know, and so he was like, yeah, that's what happened. Somebody starts mouthing off, the homeboy starts mouthing off, and then he turns back at you and he's like, hey, we got beef with these fools. Like, yo, the enemy finna ride. And it's like, no, wait. Who is we, fool? Like, you were the one that started stacking on this fool. Just like, I'm sitting here eating a taco. You was banging on homie. So now, but you know what? Am I going to say that in public? Hell no. Nah. I'm finna go ride. Like, because that's my squad. And that's so like,
have that same exact mentality.
They have the same rules. Even though you see a guy that you're like, this man is completely out of line. I mean, that's what we're watching in the news right now. We all know the killers of Breonna Taylor. We all know the killers of Joyce. Everybody there know they were out of line, right? Yeah. Ain't nobody finna say nothing because it's hood shit. You not gonna say nothing? I know because I wouldn't. If this was my hood, I'm not. I mean, I'm gonna check him when we get home. You feel me? But I'm not finna check him in public.
And that's I feel like cops don't really understand that. Like they would, if they would just check themselves, they probably would be given a lot more benefit of the doubt about stuff.
It would be so much easier
for their behalf. Like this isn't like
on their.
Like bro, if they were to come up with a rule amongst themselves, and they're like, all right, look, guys, all right, for every 10th unarmed person that gets shot, we're all going to agree that that one's bad. If they would even give that ground,
just a system,
like people wouldn't fuck with cops as much as they do,
right? I think about again, like the street part is like, at some point, one of the shot callers are gonna come from jail, right? So one of the OGs are gonna be like, all right, Parliament, you know what I'm saying? And I know that's what happened in LA. That's why drive-by stopped. It's because the OGs made the call from prison, like, hey, this is, and I hate to say it, but they were like, look, this is just not G. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't just, what are you doing? Like, you can't just drive, you hitting innocent people. Like, this is ridiculous. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? And that was because the gang checked the gang. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, and if you have somebody in your hood that's mouthing off, like you know, Bamboo's cousin, there was always a big homie I could call and be like, hey, I don't know what's up with this fool. Like, look, I mean, we handled it. Like, we went down there. We did what we had to do. But, like, God, this fool, like, he set us, like, we didn't have to have this problem. This guy was like hollering, and then that dude's gonna check him and be like, all right, tell him come up. You know what I'm saying? So like you said, like there is, it's weird, but there is an infrastructure in some way with just like street shit. Yeah.
So I learned a lot from Behind the Police about how police unions kind of operate to shield folks from accountability and keep folks on the job to sort of close the ranks up in these ways. Was there anything else from you're working on that show that really stuck out to you as like a highlight of like a piece of history you learned about the way police operate that was new to you?
Yeah, I think that like the things that really stuck out to me was like the difference between what was happening in the North and what was happening in the South, and then how they were different, but how they were interconnected. Right, right. Like, you know, the North, you know, was what the research that we saw was like, it was really about like protecting sort of like property.
Right. Yeah. The first police departments came about to break up like labor strikes and to like protect capital. And they were operating similarly in the South with slave patrols that turned into police departments protecting capital in a different way.
Yeah, exactly. So the capital was just humans.
The capital was just us.
You know, so I think that like that sort of like differences and sort of like the mind bender it was when you had sort of like labor unions striking and then the companies hiring freed Black people.
That's like the M. Night Shyamalan twist.
Yeah.
On it. What do you like say? Woo!
I don't know what to say about this one. You know what I'm saying? Because it's like how that stoked so many like even a divide even further between poor people in general, you know what I'm saying? But like, and it's like, dude, how do you untangle that? Like, these are freed slaves that are just like, yo, you mean to tell me you gonna pay me to work? That sounds great. You know what I'm saying? And being like, and from their perspective, not even understanding why anyone would possibly strike. Like, why would you do that? You know what I mean? And just that juxtaposition, just that moment in history, I think was like the most like, one, I didn't know it. And then two, it was just like, dude, like you can't, like history is just so, it's mangroves. It's so entangled and twisted. Yeah.
Hey. And yeah, I had been aware of the way that like the white and Black working class had been kind of pitted against each other to protect capital and how that is like kind of hampered labor struggles, particularly in the South historically. But I did not know about that particular piece of the history.
Yeah.
Like, damn, our own people sort of like came and undermined the movement for a little second.
Sheesh, you know? And it's like, I just like, you can't, it just reminded me of like, and I know it's trivial, but it just reminds me of like the Breaking Bad series to where you're like, I don't know whose side I'm on.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Like when you're, whether it's like Walter or Skyler, I'm like, I don't know. Cause I don't know. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So it really threw me, that section like really threw me for a loop. And then it was like, but one of the takeaways I really appreciated about this event is like, or that series is that all of those things that poor people or people of color and specifically Black people have kind of just known but had no receipts for, I feel like, yo, you're not crazy. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Here is 8 hours of receipts.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That like, so I appreciate, I like Robert was like, man, I mean, he did the Lord's work for this one. Like he did, I mean, the lifting of the receipt of the research, you know. And I just get like that feeling of being like, listen, we have something we've given to the culture that's going to stay in, you know, that's here forever, you know.
So now, so for today, we're going to look at some well-known and some less well-known songs addressing the police.
In specific, I wanted to pick songs that were more or less about police corruption.
The first being Jay Dilla's Fuck the Police. Is this another cop busted
from illegal business? They out of control. Okay, so what are your thoughts about Fuck the Police, Prout?
I mean, first of all, I'm already like a Dilla nerd, you know, so yes, there's that, right? I think that the interest of the one of the things that's so interesting about this particular song is like, you know, the backstory. Y'all heard the backstory about it?
Mm-mm.
That like, you know, he was apparently working on an album for Busta Rhymes, and mm-hmm. his basement got raided, you know, at Mom Duke's house, you know what I'm saying? His basement got raided. They destroyed tapes. They destroyed so much stuff. So that night he made that song because the police just like raided his mom's house because they heard something. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
and Dilla being who he is, like, you know, in the beginning stages of his lupus and just all this stuff was happening. Like, so like the backstory behind this song for me makes it even that much more like, no, fuck the police, not Dilla. You know what I'm saying?
It's fresh, palpable anger and shit. Like, that shit just happened.
Yeah, and you can hear, to me, it's like you can hear that in this song, that it's like,
it's definitely angry.
Yeah,
you know? It's definitely reactionary.
Yeah, this just happened. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so for me, it's like, that's why it's always been such a, like, such a stickler for me. And it's just like, you know, we had the NWA one, but like this was so like, it was such a B-boy swing because it was Dilla that it became, for me, more of an anthem, even though I'm an LA boy. That song came.
And then also around the time that I was coming up, at some point they ended up using the instrumental for this for some anime. I'm trying to remember what it was. Was it Samurai Champloo?
I can, like, when I re-listen to it, I can hear the...
Yeah.
I don't remember, yeah.
I'll go back and find out, but it was one of those joints they used to play on Adult Swim, but I just remember, like, you would hear it because all of my homies were watching that show, so you would hear that beat, and then B-boys would always break to it.
It was definitely
and then
a dancer
the first
song,
time I heard The first time I heard the song and heard the lyrics in it, I was like, oh, fuck, the song's, like, about something.
Yeah.
Like, I was just hearing the instrumental for years.
This was definitely, like, you know, the Cypher song, you know what I'm saying? The little groovers would just, like, you know, hit the middle of the circle and start doing a freestyle dance because it's just so, just that first, those first eight, like, bars are just so big, you know?
All right, up next we got... Big L, The Enemy, featuring
Fat Joe.
Making one show now, you wanna frisk me and search my ride. Call me all kind of names, try to hurt my pride. You just mad cause I'm a young cat.
So I think the overall theme for that one, it kinda is like, you know, we're legit now, we're successful, so we're not really like committing crimes anymore. But Big L chooses like convey that message like almost entirely through his interaction with police and like how that harassment is like carried on from before he was famous to now being famous.
It's this like dual consciousness, right? It's
right.
Like, okay, so we you know, we understand, you know, I mean, you know, crack sales isn't good. Like, this wasn't good for us, you know, but at the same time, you know, we understand that, you know, this stuff didn't happen in a vacuum, you know, and it wasn't necessarily the desired route for everyone, you know, just like trying to figure out like what's the best way to do this. And then when you get to a place to where you're like, okay, I could put these were crimes of survival. They weren't, nobody's scrubbing them clean. I'm not saying that these weren't bad things, you know, done, but we're out of it now,
mm-hmm.
you know? And just that letdown of like, but it's the same.
Money can't save you.
We're still treated the same.
Money can't save you at all.
It's the same. I'm still seeing the same, you know. Like the hard part of being like, I remember, it's like, we can't clean up enough. You know what I'm saying? Like, you can't, there's no, This is not how respectability politics
right,
works.
Yeah, we
like,
dress up
if
in
I
suits
put on a nice
and
suit,
go get bitten by yeah. dogs and fire hose and beaten with batons.
It makes yeah, no
and
difference.
It's like yes. the same thing where, like, class, you know, we have all these class aspirations. As hip hop artists, like, it's a part of our class aspiration, it's a part of our culture. But these things can't save you because ultimately you still have the mark of the streets on you when you roll down the street, when you, you know, get pulled over. They're going to immediately be like, where's the gun at? Are you selling rocks?
Yeah.
Like, all of these kinds of things.
They're going to be scared of you the same way and have the same sort of reaction and irrational fear and shit, like, regardless.
Yeah.
What I think about when I listen to the song is, like, I feel like if how do I say this? Like, there's a lot of interesting ways that hip-hop acts as, like, journalism for conditions on the ground for people of color. And, you know, you have a lot of songs that sort of impressionistically capture, like, life on the streets in terms of, like, what you see in your surroundings, people standing out on the street corner, altercations going down, things that are happening in your home. And then you have this other kind of subgenre, and it's funny that you brought up, like, oh, this is Jay-Z before Jay-Z, because I think, like, 99 Problems has a very similar structure as this song in terms of, like, it being an anecdote of a personal account of an interaction with police. And this is very common encounter of, like, specifically getting, like, pulled over and, like, you know, asked all these questions. Kind of like you were talking about at the beginning, like, where your mama stay at? Like, where, like, where you going? Where you been? What's in your backpack?
Yeah.
And so I'd love one day to, like, take a look at songs in this, like, I don't know, this subcategory, this classification of these, like, personal accounts of this kind of interaction, because similar to, like, Shakespeare had its sonnets and then, you know, his, like, love poems, etc. This is, like, a special kind of hip-hop song that you see over and over again.
Oh, well, can we just take 1 second just to comment on just how ill that Big L verse is? I mean,
good,
like,
Lord.
It's this shit just makes you want to, like, yo, why am I rapping?
Yeah.
All right. All right. Our next song is KRS-One, Sound of the Police. I know this for a fact. You don't like how I act. You claim I'm selling crack. Will you be doing that? I'd rather say see ya, because I would never be ya. This is so dope. Like, the parallel between with the overseer and the officer.
Yo, that was the one thing
so
I was going to say.
Do you want to talk about astute? That shit is astute.
That was the one.
Yeah, the overseer rode around the plantation, officer off patrolling all the nation. Overseer could stop you. What you doing?
Oh, man.
Officer will pull you over, like, just when he's pursuing.
It didn't hit me until I was much older when he was going, overseer, 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 overseer. Officer. I was like, oh.
Especially back then, you're like, oh, did you hear what KRS was said?
Yeah. I was like, oh, he's the greatest rapper.
Yeah.
I remember when he did that, I was like, oh, yeah, this is it.
Yeah.
Oh, there was recently, I think just the other day, Kanye West put out a new song. And the beginning of it had, it was like a recording of his mother reciting the lyrics for the song.
Oh, what?
Yeah, it's really
dope. You want to go on to the next one?
Oh, I mean, did we?
What else? What else about this one?
On this one? I mean, it's you know,
overseer officer thing, and then he kind of puts it in its, like, historical context with, like, the lineage of policing.
Yeah.
When at the end, he's like, my grandfather had to deal with the cops, my great grandfather had to deal with the cops, my great great grandfather had to deal with the cops, and then my great 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 great, when are gonna stop?
Totally. And I think again, like, you know, so Dilla's, you know, Dilla's Fuck the Police was more around my adulthood, to where I understood what was happening. You know, the Sound of the Police, like, that was more my childhood. So I didn't really, really understand what he was saying. You know what I'm saying?
I feel that.
I mean, I got it because I knew I ain't like the police. You know what I'm saying?
No, I feel that heavy. Like, to me, it's like Sound of the Police. Like, when I was a kid, it was kind of like a movie almost, right? Where you knew it was kind of, it was based on real shit, but there was, like, a certain like disconnect from it. Whereas, like, the Dilla shit, like, I was in my 20s when that was going on.
Yes,
like, that shit was, like, actually happening to me. Like, niggas was getting...
Exactly. That's what I was saying. Yeah, I was like, it wasn't happening to me when KRS was doing it. But when Dilla was doing it, I was like, yeah, I got... Yes, that's happening.
I got the perfect, like, yeah. Sound of the Police is Godfather, and Jay Dilla's Fuck the Police is Goodfellas. Bang.
Perfect. That's good.
All right, up next we got Cypress Hill, Looking Through the Eyes of the Pig. I seek it all, fuck abusers, drug dealers, and the gang banging, pieces of shit who should be on the fucking news hanging. I think this one might be unique among hip hop songs for
the perspective.
The perspective.
Yeah, I mean, definitely for. I think I have heard some other songs where people were rapping from the perspective of the cop, but this is definitely a standout one of the crop. That's for sure.
It gets so personal. Wake up in the morning, kiss my wife goodbye, hug my kids, tell them I love them, I'm out, hit the ride, like. Kind of like, it's a little uncomfortable. I think given the current discourse of, like, you know, like, within the labor movement of trying to, like, kick cops out and, like, the violence that we see on social media and in the news. And then the thin blue line people want to bring up, like, oh, they have a family and they've got kids. But, like, it's really hard to put yourself actually into that mind frame of, like, someone that could perpetrate such just villainy.
Yeah, it's and like, that's the part.
It's a more nuanced picture of the situation.
Yeah, and that's what makes the disconnect so much harder to swallow.
Yeah.
When you're like, yeah, exactly. You have a family. You have children. You understand how broken you would be to lose someone like this. Like, shouldn't you?
Should you not
like,
understand? Yeah.
Don't you understand? Yeah. Like, you know what I'm saying? So it's like. So then you have to walk away and go, okay, so my only conclusion is you don't see us as human. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, because you just told me you got a family and children, so you understand.
Yeah. And one of the things I've learned, like, in working in local government, you know, when I came into it with this mindset that, like, okay, it's me versus the enemy, which is all these conservatives that are perpetrating all this white supremacy. And then you get there and they're like, oh, I like your blazer. Oh, what's up? I'm like, hey, would you like to get a beer this afternoon? And like really nice, cordial, polite people who seem very normal. And it's very disarming. It's very disarming. And you kind of forget the mission because people are like normal, it turns out. And it makes it harder to focus on the fact that like not just how you convey yourself in terms of niceties, but actually what you do with like the policies that you either create or you operate under, how you enact like you're, you know, form part of systems that are oppressive. Like that's the judge of character, not whether or not like, oh, they kiss his wife goodbye and like, you know, wave to the folks at the donut shop on his way to work. It's these, it's this other things like that have to be disaggregated from the civility that like creates this sheen over the whole scheme of operation sometimes, and it makes it harder to like. Effectively critique how these things operate, how these things work.
Well, I think like another, you know, one of the I guess insidious, sinisterly ingenious things about like the way some of these like racist systems work is they're kind of established to the point where they don't necessarily need like bad actors in order to operate. You know what I mean? Like it can like.
Yes.
Systemic racism can operate without individual racism being present. You know what I mean?
Right. So, for example, the scheme, the modus operandi is like to over police a black community. You're not like going out and specific like in all the people you encounter in that neighborhood are black. You're not like, oh, I'm not specifically targeting anyone. It's just everyone I, you know, encountered that day and that was doing a crime. I brought them down. But the system has already put you in that scenario. Where if you operate according to just standard procedure, the outcomes are going to be racist. No matter about if you're buying kids ice cream cones or like posing for selfies at the b-ball court with whoever, inherently with the way that the policy operates to put you in that scenario in the first place is inherently a tool of oppression.
That was the biggest takeaway I think of our series, of the Behind the Police series, is that like the racism has taken on a life of its own.
Yeah.
And I think that that's the part that's hard when it's hard to communicate when we're like, listen, I'm not talking about your Uncle Dave, who's a great guy. Like, that's not who I'm talking about, you know? And they're like, well, who are you talking about? It's like, no, okay. I just don't understand why you, it's a system. You know what I'm saying? And that is the most insidious part, like you said, is that like the system of policing, no matter how many good apples you put into it, for you to survive in this system, you can't stay a good apple.
Exactly.
Yeah. Because the system's bad, you know? So I think that that's like so important for the discussion and the discourse around like abolition and just criminal justice as a whole. Like we focus specifically on policing, but the whole thing to where it's like, yeah, there's probably, you're right. There's a ton of good cops. There's a ton of good judges. You're missing the point though, you know, it's like, if you are like function in a world, like you said, of just niceties, and that there is a, which I found from just understanding, like from a sociological perspective, you know, where the conservative movement in America is trying to get to, or at least in the West,
yeah,
you know, conservative, liberal, they're transitive verbs. So it's like, you know, you're conserving what? Like liberating from what? So I'm not going to say all conservatives are this, but the direction that the conservative movement in America is going to is, at the end of the day, they have an ideal as to how society should look and work. They just happen to believe that they're the arbiters of it. Whether they know they believe that or not, they almost feel like, it's like, I think that's why like a lot of like Western, like evangelical sort of like, you know, or just religions specifically would end up leaning conservative, because they believe there's a transcendent ideal of how society is supposed to look. You know what I'm saying? It's transcendent. It's like, it's not us. It's above us. That's the way we're supposed to be. So we should all act like we're supposed to act. You know what I mean? This is the natural order of things, you know, that was given to us by some sort of transcendent divine, if you want to call it God, whatever you want to call it. At the end of the day, conservatism, at least here, believes that there is somewhere out there the answer. And we need to like, and they have figured it out.
It's like they try to tie it towards like nature, like this is the natural order of stuff. So going back to the song, we don't want to take us too far off a tangent, but I think that this song definitely, the Cypress Hill joint, it definitely has like a aura of like fantasy and entertainment like purposes towards it. It doesn't seem as serious to me as like, for example, we had a song on a few weeks ago by a dude named Marlon Kraft, a song called Gang Shit.
Yeah, it's like,
and he kind of does a similar thing where the first verse he dedicates it solely from the perspective of the cop, and it's much more serious. It doesn't get like Training Day with it, where it's like seems like you're listening to like a Jerry Bruckheimer, you know, crime thriller or something like that, which I feel the Cypress Hill song kind of does. I don't really take away from the Cypress Hill song that it's like a serious like political statement of a song.
It's like a socio-political message at all. It's just like writing exercise and inhabiting a different perspective.
Sounds like he was just picking a character to do a song.
It could have
like
easily
that.
Been a sanitation worker or like a shoe mender or something.
Like a serial killer or something.
The shock value of like looking into this different worldview or this different lifestyle for a second.
And I think B Real's like tone and his like lyrical ability at the time of this song, like it's hard to commute. I don't even think if he was trying to be serious, he wasn't developed as an artist well enough to communicate that at this moment in his career. You know what I'm saying? As he got further along, it was just like, B-Real is like, we need to cement him in the canon. You know what I'm saying? But I think at the time, it was still just this like Southgate, like, you could just kill a man, you know, you know what I mean? It was just this like, you know, just this like DJ Muggs, just this like 4x4, you know, just rhyme pattern that like he hadn't developed it yet. You know what I'm saying? So I want to give him that, to where it's like same thing, because I feel the same way. It's like, I kind of feel like maybe you were getting there, but like, I don't know. It feels a little more lighthearted. Yeah.
Well, I think that's gonna do it for us today for the music discussion. You know, I wanted to thank you, Propaganda, for coming through our show. Hey, can you tell the people where they can find you?
Yeah. You can find me at Prop Hip Hop. That's all of my socials, and it's my website too, prophiphop.com. There's also a little thing we're doing for coffee and black people. It's called, which is prophiphop.com/coffee. You know, coffee only grow at the equator, right? And who live at the equator? So we just got a collection of by POC, like roasters and shops that I'm a coffee dude. So like just ways to support like smaller roasters that are like doing the good work.
That's what's up.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on today.
My pleasure. This is the dopest. I said yes off the strength of the name of the pod. I was like, let's go. Yes, I want to be on this.
Well, shit, we're starting a little tradition of, spitting bars to open up and close out the show. So I think you're going to be our first guest spitter with us today. Yo, let's get a beat. Let's get this shit popping.
Thanks for having me on the show, though. Yeah, we dodged bullets from Damos and boys in blue, that's all we knew. Red rags and badges all the same when it came through. Flaming through the gardens and jungles like where you stay at. You don't look familiar, won't play that, homie, say that. What's that tat? Oh, you run with that other clique, right? We seen you the other night, thugging, right? And I'ma need some ID and a reason you round these parts on set. We got the burners on deck. Oh, we prayed for his life like little unarmed me. He done called for backup, here come his army. And odds are, if you living not far from the hood, they pulled up in a squad car. Take your odds are.
I'm losing cool over nothing. I'm losing count of the commas. Jacuzzi pool hot one rumbling to the sound of the samba. Thunderclouds of ganja got you coughing like what they bury you underground. I'm down in vodka mixed with hookah. They nut on her like it's puppy chowing. I'm the hunting hound. Bark, bark, bitch. Let me off the leash and take several seats on the park bench. Look me in the eyes. What you know about darkness? Please call the police. I dare him send a squad of cars
in. They gonna
in.
Throw us in the pee now. While niggas sitting up, I gotta bust a freestyle. 45 on TV talking like you see now. I'ma go and cure the world like I was in Green Mound. Now I'm not a politician, I'm not a fucking actor. Whatever you think of asking, I do it for the rappers. I don't got a pocket pissing and I don't have a master. So I don't be singing, dancing, and cooning for the crackers. I hope that you don't get offended. Let's take it as just pretend. If you touch my microphone, then hello to my little friend. I'm reloaded, it's just too crazy. Waiting on reparations like fuck you pay me, dope. Yo, my name is Dope Knife.
I'm Lingua Franca.
And we are waiting on reparations. See you next week.
See you next week.
Waiting on Reparations is a production of iHeartRadio.
Listen to Waiting on Reparations on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.